All right, we're back with anarcho film critic Daniel. Listeners might remember him from our episode about Mad Max last week ago, which was the first time you were ever on the show.
First time, long time.
Now you live in Chicago, is that right?
That's right. I live in the city of Chicago.
Chi-town. It's evidently a city just teeming with birds because I hear a bunch of tweeting in the background.
That's why they call it the Windy Apple.
Number one city in the world, baby. Go Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're going to have another episode that's largely about our experiences in the pro-Palestine movement and the student camps. I'm going to talk a little bit about New School. And Daniel, you've been involved in you've had your hands in a couple pies.
I mean, maybe in my early 20s, but... So who amongst us? In Chicago, there have been a few encampments that have popped up at various points. With friends and comrades, we've been at basically all of them here in the city. I have personally spent the most time at Northwestern U Chicago, and then there was a shorter action at SAIC, which is the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which is connected to a museum.
Isn't that where Chris Cotrone teaches?
That may be where Chris Cotrone teaches, yes.
And I imagine he was out there like interviewing protesters and learning about what the movement is about, right? Because he talks about it so much. He surely is engaging with the actual movement and seeing what it is.
If there's anything I know about Chris Cotrone, it's steady, updated engagement with things as they currently are.
You guys are spicy today, huh? One mention of Chicago.
I don't know why I do it to myself and like listen to Cotrone. Like I don't have to. I don't get much out of it these days.
Well, maybe instead of listening to Cotrone, you should listen to your parents.
Well, I thought what you were going to say is okay. You made a joke about this last time too. You're implying that I have daddy issues. I don't know what you're implying with this.
You guys have a history I wasn't even aware of.
Here I thought I was just talking about platypus, but sure, yeah, maybe that too.
You guys have some spicy repartee going on here. I guess I'll have to be the mediator on this.
Yeah, you could check out our Mad Max episode and hear a little bit about our BDSM relationship that we established there.
So did you do one on, because I missed it, on the most recent one or the one before that? The Fury Road or Furiosa?
Both. We talked about the entire franchise.
Oh, cool.
Through the work of Nick Land.
Look at me being an asshole and not even listening to our own content. That sounds lit.
Yeah, check it out. But check out the Antifa. Yeah.
And you can check it out on patreon.com/ I don't know what it is, but
the Antifa. Yeah, so I thought what you're going to say is don't listen to Cotrone, listen to Postone. And I think we're going to work our way there. Wow. Because
isn't that one and the same, though? Like, Cotrone is a Postonist.
Exactly. And I think he articulated a position on Zionism and Palestine that's often really misunderstood because, like Cotrone, he was a bit of a gadfly or a contrariat in his latter days. But I sent a couple articles out that we'll talk about later in the episode, maybe as part of a bonus, where we're gonna look at that position, but we're gonna work our way there. We're not gonna start with Postone's anti-Zionism. We're gonna start with our own, and work our way there. Mm-hmm. If that sounds good to you guys,
sure,
sounds great.
Yeah,
we
so
haven't touched on Palestine, you and I, Andy, in a long time, and a lot has happened subsequently in the last few months, including a hostage rescue situation that happened that resulted in four hostages.
A very courageous hostage rescue where they killed 200 and murdered 400. And just, I saw a video of just a street lined with dead bodies, like as if they just murdered everyone, rampaging to wherever these hostages were. Really, really horrific shit.
Yeah, really, really, really dark shit going on still.
But do either of you have like sort of overall takes or impressions on the current situation of this war?
Well, in terms of, let's see, we're speaking on June 9th, so I think people should be aware of that because things change.
True.
I have what will probably come out as we talk more. My general take is whatever is happening in Israel, Palestine, is unfortunately, or actually perhaps extremely fortunately, not the domain of politics for us, meaning those of us who are speaking from the United States, which is not to say that what we do has no relationship to what's happening there, but the question is instead, what then should our relationship be to what's going on over there? And that's just to say that, yeah, I don't really have any strong, great cutting position about how the Palestinian resistance should continue or about what the geopolitical actors will end up negotiating in terms of a ceasefire or a hostage deal. But I do feel committed to the idea that as leftists or whatever umbrella you want to use in the United States, we have a responsibility to stop the American war machine from continuing to participate, not just arm, but participate in the ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people. And at least what I've seen that seems exciting to me, we'll see if it turns into anything, is in the Bay Area, about a week ago, there was an occupation, very briefly, of the Israeli consulate, I think, not an embassy, a consulate. It was very short-lived, but that seems interesting. And likewise, there have also been calls recently for demonstrations outside of Egyptian embassies and consulates. And I think that those are extremely promising for reasons we'll probably get into.
Yeah, I'll add to that, and yeah, hopefully we'll talk a little bit about have our own report backs from the camps that we went to in a second. But one of the questions I wrote when I outlined this a couple weeks ago is like, well, the semester's ending. Usually, when there's student occupation movements or student movements in general, it just ends with a semester. And yeah, of course, there's been like a big downtick, but we have seen a lot of renewed camps and occupations in UCLA, at Columbia, New School until just about a week ago when they sort of won their main demands. I would say that this movement does appear to have more sticking power just because like we are seeing fresh carnage every day, and mobilizing at the universities is sort of like a ready-made tactic,
right?
That got a ton of traction. You know, it was like the major story almost worldwide for like war itself. Yeah, for weeks.
There is a certain danger, though, that the tactics that were appropriate for American university divestment campaigns, which had the possibility of turning into something a little deeper, which is why I and I assume the two of you were interested in what was going on campuses, because obviously, divesting from the Israeli war machine is a worthwhile task, but at the same time, we know it's grossly insufficient. In the city of Chicago, for instance, you know, I'm in a lot of action threads and telegrams and stuff, and I get these messages from all kinds of different political groups, which I'm sure we'll end up talking about. It's been odd, shall we say, as someone who also identifies with a kind of anarchist, ultra-leftist, whatever tradition, communist tradition, having to be in direct dialogue and work with people who have politics that are very explicitly counter to my own, which is just to say, I get lots of, you know, urgent support needed, XYZ thing is happening, but it seems that the tent is now the meme and setting up tents is a stand-in for protests rather than actually being encampments. So for instance, a very large, very important park in Chicago yesterday had an encampment set up. You can't see me doing air quotes because we're on a podcast. But
you also weren't doing it.
Well, the fact that you can see me.
Yeah. Ding, ding. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Seth.
You can't see him doing it because he didn't do it.
Right. But I was doing it in my heart. And, you know, the thing here is there's no distinction between the air quotes and non-air quotes, as it were.
Your heart is a sarcastic gesture the size of your fist. Love
interesting. Exciting. Yes. And that's just to say that in this very large public space, public park, we received all these messages over Telegram and Signal threads saying there's an encampment being set up, a very large encampment being set up. Come defend the encampment. And of course, nobody could have possibly defended that, nor was there any, it seems, even attempt at defending that. And, you know, there was obviously a politics of safety built into that. Don't come to this unless you are already about to be arrested right now, which is the way that a lot of the concerns about safety have played out over the last couple of weeks. But it just means that now it almost seems like the tensor sort of a force multiplier or something, but I'm not even sure that they work on that level, meaning they make it so a small protest seems like a bigger protest. You throw down a bunch of tents and now all of a sudden it takes up a lot more space. But there doesn't seem to be any attempt at actually turning that space into an area that is, you know, controlled in quotation marks, insofar as a small part of a campus can be controlled.
This conversation is happening after I just spent a week in Yellowstone out west, seeing the bears and the bisons and the elks and everything like that. Jellystone shit. So maybe for other people too who are less familiar with the context of things, you mentioned that there are political divisions within these encampments and there are like rolling campuses in parks now. I mean, give us like a kind of rundown of what's happening in Chicago and what the differences are.
In terms of the spread of politics, the different types of sort of factions involved, it's really hard for me to actually be able to clearly pick them out, partially because I think this movement by and large relies in a good sense on common sense and also kind of in a bad sense on a sort of default politics that, I mean, without divulging too much personal information here, I am Jewish, in case that was unclear from the previous one or the sound of my voice. And much like Andy's, I don't know what to call what Andy said, but I did listen to the episode where you guys, when October 7th first happened, talked about this.
Where I renounced my Judaism?
Yeah, I mean, exactly, where you gave it up and, you know, you turned back in your membership card and you don't get invited to the meetings and whatever.
Andy gave me his Israeli passport. He said, here, I don't want this anymore. You hold on to it. I said, no problem. Maybe I'll do it.
They don't really check there.
Do they accept German Irish or no?
I mean, yes, unfortunately, as it turns out. So, yeah, for me, I always wanted to sort of stand back from the Israel-Palestine stuff because it seemed insanely overdetermined, among other reasons. And what I mean by that is there's a certain type of politics that's dominant on the U.S. left, which is obviously what we're going to end up talking about today, in relation to how Israel operates, what Israel's relationship is with the United States, the cause of Palestinian nationalism. And obviously, these are all things worth talking about, but they're places that made it really difficult for me to find any political affinity with people who are deeply invested in the Palestinian struggle as the struggle that defines the United States or, you know, the modern age or whatever framing. And that just means that when you go to the encampments, you know, there's a lot of like soft Maoism, a lot of soft nationalism, and there's a lot of other stuff like that floating around. I personally did not witness any of this anti-Semitism that people are super concerned about on college campuses. I think obviously there's an easy critique of that from the left, which is just that, you know, it's cynical weaponization of the fear of anti-Semitism rather than actual anti-Semitism. And I think that that's mostly right. But the political space itself is overdetermined by big leftist orgs. It means that in some places, the Party for Socialism and Liberation plays a pretty outsized role, including, I know, at the Northwestern encampment, which ended in tears, as it were, the PSL was involved, or at least a PSL member was involved in that decision, and it actually created a lot of hostility.
What do you mean, ended in tears?
So the Northwestern encampment was, to the best of my knowledge, it was the first one that ended with claiming a victory out of a defeat. And what I mean by that is the occupation was set up, deoccupation, unoccupation. The terminology of these is quite confusing to me at this point, just because it's used so, what's the right word, in an unstandardized way.
Yeah, I've seen a few like Instagram stories that have many levels of double negative involving that. Yeah. It's like they've cleared our deoccupation and we're going to re-deoccupy. And
exactly.
It's like a little complicated.
Negation.
Yes.
is a deoccupation of the reoccupation of the occupied.
Yeah. Now we're getting to Hegel.
Damn. Yes. It's more of a spiral, really, if you think about it. But the point is just that the Northwestern encampment was set up with, much like a lot of these encampments, it required a little bit of legwork at the beginning to set it up. Some comrades were involved in that. And very quickly, there was a small group of people who identified themselves as organizers who became the sort of center and mediators of the camp. The camp ballooned and grew very rapidly. It went from being that first morning, like a dozen people maybe, to being by the end of it, several hundred, probably. My guess when I was there in the evening at the peak was probably somewhere around 500 people. So it was quite large, and there was a loud sound system, and there's a million supply tents, sort of the impulse of the mutual aid stuff from 2020, and it seemed like things were going pretty good. And I think it was a day later, maybe 2 days later. The problem is the timeline in all these also now is honestly, it becomes a little mushy now that we're a little bit more removed from it, because there was a brief period where, 24 hours of every single day were involved in these encampments. And now that the semester's over, quarters are over, things are a little different. But this small group of people who appointed themselves the organizers and therefore the mediators of the camp entered into an agreement with Northwestern that they would dismantle the camp, which they did very rapidly, and they called it a win. The concessions that they got were abysmally bad, and they're things like an Islamic student's house is what they call it, but it's essentially like a small little bureaucratic structure in Northwestern that's supposed to liaison with Muslim students. And I think a guarantee of somewhere between 2 and 5 scholarships for students from Gaza sometime over the next 10 years. So assuming there are any people who are students who are still alive by then, great, I guess.
Or any universities to liaison with.
Exactly. And then also to bring, there's a non-binding agreement to have Northwestern begin to renew its finance or review its finances in order to determine what connections it has that it could then possibly sever, but they're not doing that until the fall, which is just to say that they got nothing.
It's like student loan deferment. If you open a small business in a historically underdeveloped area, like the old Kamala Harris promise from, 2020?
Yeah, it's just it's promises that are basically worth nothing, honestly, is the actual thing. They're promises that are worth nothing. And the university just wanted the encampment to stop, and they got their wish. And it's just back to this question about orgs then, it becomes difficult, particularly in this situation, because it's so student activist, to have a clean kind of narrative about the way that the orgs function in a general sense. You can really only look at the particularities and then find places where they serve this kind of recuperative or repressive role. But at the same time, also have to acknowledge that often it's the case in many places that big Palestinian solidarity orgs are exactly the reason the encampment started to begin with. So, groups like the PSL, or excuse me, not the PSL, the SJP, or JVP, right? At the institutions that I am formally affiliated with, I never really fucked with SJP or JVP. The students who were involved in them mostly were just pretty annoying, and that was the reason to not be involved. Politics actually had nothing to do with it. But in the case of, for instance, Columbia, right, which is obviously the epicenter of this movement where everything sort of spread out from, there is no chance that anything like the encampments would have happened were it not for the fact that the students who had been formerly affiliated with SJP and JVP set them up. And the reason that they seem to have set them up is because their student organizations were repressed out of existence very quickly by the Columbia administration, which meant that those students then felt like they had to take, more militant isn't the right word, I think, in this case, but more visible escalatory action. Yeah, sure.
Well, these are um, these are old organizations on the left, right? Students for Justice in Palestine and
Jewish Voices for Peace.
Jewish Voices for Peace. Yeah. These are ones that were around when I was in college back in the day. They were institutions, right? Which is why it was so shocking to see them not only banned but also slandered in so many ways, because they did like quiet work for many, many years above the radar, and certainly in coalition with many other like progressive and leftist groups on campus. So the suppression and repression of these groups obviously elicited this great reaction, but also like I think signifies the real depth to which the opposing forces in this struggle will go and start tearing institutional and organizational and political groups up from the root in the face of this series of atrocities.
Well, maybe this would be a good time for me to add a little bit of my experience at the New School. So they had an initial occupation around the same time that NYU and Columbia did, that lasted for about a week or two, and then it was cleared out by the police. And they actually, the most scandalous part about it was not only that the police came in and arrested the occupying students, but that there was two occupations, one in Parsons and one in 65 Fifth Avenue. And the Parsons one was sort of expected to be safe. That was sort of the green area where, you know, exchange students and people who should not be arrested for various reasons were.
And it was a free speech zone, like the Republican National Convention in 2004.
Yeah, more or less, like the university, I think, implied that place would be okay to camp. And the police came and, on their own initiative, but like with the permission of the school, cleared and arrested students at both of them. About a week later, and I think those occupations were largely organized and controlled by some of these traditional groups that we're talking about. About a week later, a coalition of faculty and students, including our friend Natasha Leonard, helped organize a new re-deoccupation of 65 Fifth Avenue right in the lobby. And at this point, the president, Donna Shalali, another kind of ex-congresswoman liberal stooge, the president of the New School, her reputation was so badly damaged, there was a vote of no confidence that she knew it would not be good to just call the cops and clear this one again. So that one lasted. I don't even know if it officially ended. They camped. I was a part of that for a couple of days. They had tons of events. They put camps like really obtrusively around the lobby to make sure that people couldn't just ignore it. And they escalated by occupying the Student Welcome Center. And I think with a more or less hard occupation that they had to fight their way to get into, took the entire building, a major escalation. And again, they had the administration had trouble justifying calling the police and arresting everybody. And the result of this was that the Board of Trustees in New School will have a vote on divestment. And it, from what I'm hearing, it appears that they will divest. So this will be not a victory and defeat, but just a straight up victory on what they are demanding. Now, getting into the sort of tension between anarchist and ultra-left politics and like a more reformist demand of let's have a more just school in terms of how the school invests, this is something that I brought up with some people there. Because I had printed, you know, being a New School occupation hobbyist, I guess, you know, having occupied the New School a couple of times. Yeah, and just coming back whenever there's an occupation to check it out. I printed out some of the text from the 2008-2009 New School occupations and passed it around. And some of the people there were really into it. They had, like, more of an anarchist line. And we talked about it, and I said, like, look, I like these texts. I think they can be helpful in some way. But I don't know if it's appropriate for this situation, because back then we were just trying to
exploit
the terrain of the university to open a vortex in the streets, not in the university itself. You know, we didn't care about the university. We didn't want to make it better or more just or like a better place to learn or anything. We were kind of more like an Animal House group of frat boys who were fucking with the dean for our own sick pleasure. And this is a camp that's run largely by Palestinians and radical students, and they have a real strategy that's part of this larger movement of, you know, sort of in the BDS framework of things. And I think that's a worthy goal for you guys to fight for, and maybe being complete assholes like we were might not be the best way. And so we sort of got in these discussions to a place where we're saying, like, well, maybe through being assholes and escalating how asshole-ish we can be, we will push towards winning that goal. And I'm like, yes, maybe, but, you know.
Well, I think also, though, without having to relitigate.
And I guess they did, yeah.
Yeah, without having to relitigate, you know, the last 15 years or something, it is sort of funny that these groups who have these extremely modest demands in the scheme of, you know, if you understand what's happening, let's assume that everybody believes what they're saying. And I mean, I believe it, right? That
yeah, I think that the United honest.
States is that the United States is currently participating in a genocide in Gaza by arming Israel and otherwise militarily assisting it. If you actually believe that, trying to get a bunch of American universities to withdraw money from companies that are somehow involved in Israel, to me, does not actually seem proportionate at all. It's extremely mild. It's extremely reformist. It's extremely milquetoast, et cetera. Now, we know, obviously, this is just a thought experiment here. We know that universities are a flashpoint for larger political issues in the United States. The way the spectacle operates means that stuff that happens on college campuses has more weight, et cetera. Blah, 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 blah. But that's just to say that a bunch of people who believe themselves to be doing something important and moral and are trying to preserve the institution as an institution, not abolish it, not spill over into a general riotous orgy of insurrection into the streets, but are trying to achieve a concrete political goal, which is having a bunch of people in a boardroom decide that they're going to give their money to a bunch of different capitalist firms rather than the capitalist firms they're giving it to now. Those people were 100 billion times more disruptive than those of us who said that we wanted to open the vortex and occupy everything and burn the university to the ground, etc.
You mean they used various means to undermine the sort of escalatory tactics? Is that what it is?
What I mean is just that the student movement here has gone way beyond the student movement of, you know, in the wake of the financial crisis, in terms of being able to actually disrupt the functioning of the university, which, you know, raises a question about the relationship between the politics being expressed and the actions being taken. And of course, the actual situation that the students find themselves in. Right. The American campus is a particularly politically loaded space right now, and especially because of the congressional hearings around universities and university presidents. It means that even if you had a more modest politics right now that was not oriented towards the total destruction of the American state, you could actually have a pretty outsized effect on the way that the university operates. Whereas the terrain that we were operating on, you know, when we were young people, we're so old now, was more, you know, I don't know how else to say it. Who gives a shit? Okay, you know, we occupied the new school. Who cares? That used to be the thing. Now it's, oh, right, because there's, what, 50, 100 university occupations happening all over the country, and they're actually disruptive, and they're actually a national news item, and there's a lot going on. And I'm not sure that has to do directly even with having a long-term strategy of targeting American universities by groups like Students for Justice in Palestine. Though it's not unrelated, but I don't think that we can also just say, well, you know, these groups have dug in roots deep enough that it meant that when they were ready to strike, no, it's completely situational. It's the fact that they were banned. It's the fact that there's the war. There's all this stuff that makes the sort of calculus, honestly, sort of random. And what I'm trying to say here is just, it's really, really hard to parse out the actual relationship between politics. I'm, again, doing scare quotes without doing scare quotes. It's hard, ding, ding, politics. It's really hard to parse out the way that politics actually interacts with the current moment, meaning as actors who step into these situations, it's unclear to me what the relationship is between what we think we're doing and what we actually do when we do things like set up tents or spend time with students.
I'm thinking about the ways that in the late 60s and 1970s, council communist groups, left communist groups, and the situationists in particular, tried to interface and understand what was going on in the universities. I was in the Bay Area last Christmas to visit my family, and I found in an old bookstore like an actual paper copy of the 10 days that shook the university by the Situationist International. And there's also the famous Root and Branch, which was Paul Maddock Jr. and what's his name? Not Philip Roth.
Brecker?
Yeah, Brecker. Root and Branch basically was out of Cambridge, and they wrote a pamphlet called No Class Today, No Ruling Class Tomorrow, Lessons of the Student Strike. And in that period, obviously, with the Vietnam War popping off, and obviously society in France being shaken by the kind of the end of the 30 glorious years and the doldrum of the end of the Fordist period, you had militants kind of our stripe arguing that the student strikes will be insufficient, maybe sufficient to affect U.S. policy decisions in the Vietnam War or to affect the Gaullist regime in France, but that ultimately it's workers' struggle that will be the deciding factor, revolutionary factor in this. So I wonder, do we still believe that? And if we believe that, do the PSL still believe that? And what is the mechanism by which these things are supposed to segue into one another?
Yeah, that's a great way of framing it. I think a lot of like a sort of continuity with people who have that perspective is that in a way, even if we're fighting as students, if we've got these broader revolutionary ambitions, we see what the students as doing as like a learning experience in delegitimizing these institutions. Mm-hmm. And you will see as you fight the university for a reasonable demand, you will see what the university really is. And I think this movement has done that in a way to the point where I think if we talk about universities at the beginning of the fall semester and we talk about it now, we're talking about a university that actually sees itself differently in terms of like the university occupations in the past. They were trying to constrain the politics to an acceptable range. And now the discourse amongst administrators and a lot of faculty even is maybe universities shouldn't be political at all. Like we should drop all political pretense, so that's a major shift. And I think if we're going to continue to see massive politicization in response to the atrocities that anyone who cares to pay attention is witnessing, that's going to become a problem, because what they did at the New School, for example, conceding to these demands, giving the students what they asked for, is a far more effective strategy than that they've learned, which is calling the police and shutting it all down. And that'll just continue to happen.
Absolutely. And I don't get, you know, the security briefs every morning or what have you, so I can't play galaxy brain strategist. But it's so bizarre to me that universities didn't immediately just realize the way to deal with these encampments is to just let them do them and then wait for the semester to end. It's ludicrous to me that they decided to bring down the hammer as hard as they did. Because it has backfired in basically every single instance until they actually defeat the encampment, but at the serious loss of legitimacy.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like there's no context for this, right? Like we saw very clearly in the pages of the newspaper and in magazines and in Twitter accounts that it's not like they just decided, oh, these students of ours need to be repressed. They were getting massive, massive, massive pressure from their donor base, you know? And this was...
And politicians
as well. So this very quickly went from like a small P political thing in universities to like a larger political thing that has implications for not just the university itself, but like ruling class control over the university, which I think despite everything that's happened is still very much the case, right? That universities in their current guise, and perhaps different from 50 years ago when you saw the Vietnam War student strike, which shut universities down for months. You know, universities in the last 50 years have now become far different.
The
administrative wise and with endowments, where I'm sure that the Harvard endowment in 1970 was pretty good. But nowadays, you're talking about tens of billions of dollars and like strewn across the private universities, especially hundreds of billions of dollars at stake here. The management of that and the reproduction of that is obviously more important than the PR effects, right?
Right. And I think that I don't want to lose, Sean, your question that you raised a minute ago about how the student struggles relate to a sort of larger social process of struggle. But just on this point that you just raised, I think there's a lot of different versions of the argument. And unfortunately, one of the main versions that pops up is essentially like an Israel lobby university argument, right? Where there's like these high-powered financier donors who have connections to Israel, and they're like, we need to maintain these connections at all cost. Therefore, we need to crush the students as quickly as possible because they're calling into question our ties. I think that's actually just nonsense. There are some institutions where there are obviously Zionist donors, et cetera, who do care about those things. I don't want to pretend they don't exist. But something that's really telling, and it's odd to me, I haven't seen more about this, is the president of Colombia, for instance, Manoush Shafiq, Baroness Manoush Shafiq.
Formerly of the WTO, is it?
The World Bank. She was the vice president of the fucking World Bank. And people talk about
WTO, my bad.
Right. No, and people talk about, you know, the neoliberal university. Academics love talking about the neoliberal university. It's like the fucking vice president of the World Bank is the president of Colombia, and she's the one calling the police and telling them to, like, let's be real. In the case of New York, right? There was a gun fired in the occupied building. She's calling the police and telling them to basically kill the students in order to quash this. And I think that the actual issue here is when we're talking then about the, you know, the sort of donors, whatever you want to call them, the trustees of these universities, the issue isn't, as, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but the issue isn't so much, you know, the university must maintain its ties to Israel at all costs. The issue is, the university is a giant fucking hedge fund, and nobody should be looking at how we do our money. Fuck you. You're not allowed to look at our finances. This is how universities run. And in order to keep growing the endowment and not touch the principal, we need to keep managing our money the way that we see fit. And we do not want democratic control of that. It has,
yeah.
I don't want to say it has nothing to do with Israel, but the actual issue here is basically that the finance, the way these institutions operate financially is essentially by design a black box, and they don't want anybody looking into it. So it's not just, oh, well, you know, you're financing a genocide. They could stop doing that in a second. It wouldn't actually hurt their bottom line at all. But it raises the possibility of people having something more like democratic control of the way the university operates. And that actually is terrifying to them.
Yeah, because their entire job is based on administering and managing the university, and democratic accountability obviously puts impediments into their way. You know, I think that I agree with you. It's not like a grand, like, Zionist APAC, you know, conspiracy. There's no cabal out there. I think another issue on top of what you were saying too, is that especially Harvard, MIT, Columbia, Stanford, even some of the larger public schools, right? These are meant to be, and I think they're less and less more this case, they're meant to be venues for the reproduction of, like, both a managerial middle class and also, like, more broadly, like, entrepreneurial and political ruling class.
Yeah.
And so the disruptions that happen at these headline universities, these Ivy League universities, don't require a cabal to come in and say, we're quashing all dissent on the Gaza genocide. It's instead that, like, these are our institutions, right? It's not just that we give money to them as a, out of a sense of charity, right? It's that these institutions, which produced ourselves, are meant to be these, like, neutral, which is to say, like, imperial venues for the reproduction of our conceptions and our ideas about how we have to rule the world, how we might rule the world, how our rule will continue.
Yeah, I don't know if she's still on staff, but, you know, Hillary Clinton was in the public policy school at Columbia for a while after her.
Yeah, speaking of the Dems, this is another aspect of it that I think might help us broaden out more to the, you know, national politics, like, outside the universities, which is that it's interesting to me that what the students are calling for, I mean, there's different, you know, different strains of it. Some of it are more like decolonial, or, like, you know, really more orienting towards, like, Palestinian armed struggle in, you know, rhetorical or aesthetic ways. But I think the main thrust of it is calling for the Biden administration just to fulfill its own stated policy, which is we know not what they actually want. I think the reality of it is probably Biden and Netanyahu are working with the exact same, you know, frame of policy. But the Biden administration does say that there should be a Palestinian state that they would like to recognize a Palestinian state, that they would like to not cede any ground in Gaza, that Gaza should be rebuilt somehow, and that there should be some sort of normalization of relations between Palestinians and Jewish Israelis. And it's not too far from what students are demanding. And you see a similarity in terms of like how the university portrays itself as ethical and oriented towards human rights and justice and racial justice and that sort of thing.
And free speech too.
And so I think the movement in general is trying to push liberalism or liberal bureaucrats and politicians towards actually doing what they say. This is not a critique of the movement. I think that's totally a reasonable terrain to struggle on, like calling out that hypocrisy and showing how it's bullshit. But in terms of the political terrain, it's still constrained around that framework of like, I thought this was a rules-based international order. You know, yeah. I thought we believed in global compromise and the ICJ and all that sort of stuff. Like, why are we now throwing that out in the face of a clear genocide? It's a totally reasonable framework, but it's still one that is trying to just perfect liberalism. And the reason for that is not because, oh, the students are too stupid and they haven't read enough Marx or whatever, but it's because there isn't an autonomous there isn't a different kind of politics to push for or to fight for other than what's in theory or what's in history.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. No, I was going to say the Catronist point, right, is kind of what Andy said. We're back to Catron, and I don't stand him on Gaza, though I do stand him on other things, is that, you know, ultimately this is an intramural battle within progressivism, which is to say within the Democratic Party, over fulfilling the promises of that liberalism. Therefore, it can't go beyond that, right? Because that's what it is in essence, is a civil war within the Democratic Party. That, I think, is largely true, by and large. But I wonder what, like, then the question I asked, like, with the ILC people, right, is, like, if that is true, what's going to be left over at the end of this? Because this is going to end. Biden will force some sort of peace deal in the end. It'll be horrific and terrible for the Palestinian people. Will probably involve some sort of recognition by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states of Israel to sort of like make sure that Zionism reproduces itself moving forward. I guess like what's left over at the end of this, when this finally ends, are there independent, like Andy was saying, independent institutions being built? Is there a sort of way to funnel this energy into something that'll be larger than the university and larger even than this very particular series of atrocities in the Middle East? Like, is it just going to be that the PSL gets more members? Is there going to be something else formed out of it? I wonder, Daniel, what you've seen on the ground that points beyond the limitations of this struggle itself.
Yeah, and I think this also loops back to the question you raised before. So before I address directly what you just said, I think that the strength that can't be understated about the interventions in the 1960s by ultra-leftists, particularly the Situationists, on the poverty of student life comes to mind, and I saw that being distributed at a lot of camps around the country, which is good, was an attempt at a direct intervention to connect the... Let's put it this way. It was already obvious to everyone in the 1960s, and partially it was a function of, in France, it was because the Algerian War was so fresh. In the United States, it's because Korea and Vietnam meant a draft. There was a very, very real material sense in which the misery in the hyper-exploited parts of the Third World that were now having these wars, that misery was directly connected to the daily life of students. Mm. And I think that there's a certain sense in which that link hasn't... People try to make that link, but it seems to happen more on the level of ideology, more of like a one struggle, all one fight thing, rather than people saying... The only version of it that I see is, you know, unfortunately, the ridiculous one that then like the Post or like the Zionist groups glom onto when, you know, someone says like, well, we're all Hamas. And it's like, well, you're not. We're not, right? I mean, even if we are fighting on some level on the same side because we're fighting against the occupation, we live in the United States. We live in radically different conditions than what's happening in the Middle East right now. And there is some kind of connection, but the connection to me often feels like an emotional connection where, yeah, I am horrified by what I'm seeing. And I think it's important to act on that, but it's not super obvious. People haven't really laid out a sort of clear, the misery of being a student is connected to the misery that's being exported around the rest of the world in the form of military violence. And without that connection, it becomes a little more difficult to imagine what kind of long-term politics can come out of this moment. The thing, though, that I would say I can see coming out of this, and I have seen in Chicago, is sort of, as I think, Andy, you raised before, you have these groups of people who are now working side by side, these students and others, right? Because let's be clear, it's a student movement, but not everyone who's there is a student. It takes place on college campuses, and the language around is this only for students or is this for someone else was definitely a space that a lot of people around the country had to fight in, right? Trying to get people to reject the artificial distinction between students and non-students, particularly in, you know, university towns. I live in Chicago, and if you live anywhere near the University of Chicago, people who aren't affiliated with the university often were affiliated with the university, whether it's because they went there a long time ago or maybe just because they graduated 6 months ago. So the idea that there's, you know, suddenly an ontological difference between someone who graduated last year and someone who's still on campus is ridiculous. But the point is just that these students who have been forced into this situation, and I think this is really different from the kind of leftist, non-reformist reforms point, right? Where, you know, you fight, and because you finally get a concession, it means that the system can't handle the concession, and therefore, you know, the whole thing, but that seems nonsense to me. But what does seem true is that students and their allies, comrades, friends, fighting against the administration create new spaces for political encounter and new spaces for encounter on the level of tactics, and create new commitments to one another about what it means to keep each other safe, about what it means to struggle together. And in that process, start forming new, you know, sometimes they're actual political groups, sometimes they're affinity groups, sometimes they're just friend circles, but they create these commitments to one another that allow them to learn and think and strategize together. And as a, you know, ultra leftist, anarchist, whatever, to me, that seems like the thing that's actually important in terms of, you know, our political situation in the United States is the formulation of new layers of people who are able to think and concretely strategize together in order to achieve goals. That by necessity involves something like political education, but I don't think that that has to operate on the level of here are the texts, go read them. The educators also need educating. We've all heard this before. The thing that really matters is that these groups of people keep working together, keep thinking together, keep fighting together. And in Chicago, I know for a fact that there are several new layers of people who are doing that, which is great, which is just to say that there are now new groups of comrades who are not part of an existing scene. And hopefully, without, you know, dragging them into the swamp of existing scene politics, these now become people that we can collaborate with. And we have a sort of broader, bigger ecosystem of people who share, if not all the same politics, broadly speaking, a similar orientation towards direct action, a similar orientation towards more horizontal forms of organizing and decision making, and broadly speaking, share an orientation towards revolution. I mean, towards thinking that things really need to change if things are going to change.
When I brought up Root and Branch and I brought in up the Situationist International, I could bring up two, and maybe there's like a few more groups who are oriented towards like working class revolution. Within that, I mean, certainly there were in the 70s all sorts of like Maoist groups. There was the Weather Underground. There was Marxism-Leninism writ large. There was Trotskyism. I wonder if like the educational aspect of this. And I believe you're right about like creating new cadres of people who are open to new ideas. If the educational aspect to this is to try to generalize, and you can make some generalizations about what's happening in Israel-Palestine right now, generalize that into saying that, like, I don't know, the settler colonial versus indigeneity aspect of this is the universal, right? Which is to say that, like, everything is settler colonialism. Right. If that is the universal, then you're educating people, but we're educating them, I think, away from a sort of like ultra left or like workers' politics and towards something that's, I don't know, more like, I don't know if it's any good. I don't know. Andy and I read Settlers this last year, right? And
yeah, like, I heard.
It comes out of Settlers. I mean, I'm not sure it's a very worthwhile politics. Certainly the issues brought up both in Settlers and also in this conflict and the fight against this ongoing genocide, that in itself is good. But like, what are we teaching people?
You know, there's a really beautiful footnote in one of the Freddie Perlman texts. I think it's on the continual appeal of nationalism. For people mm-hmm. who are less familiar, because you know this does have an audience. For people who are less familiar, Freddie Perlman is kind of the granddaddy of the American ultra-left tradition. Lauren Goldner, who I know you guys had a memorial episode for recently, RIP, was very, very good friends with the Perlmans. Lorraine is still alive, but Freddie Perlman was an immigrant to the United States who founded Black and Red Press in Detroit with some other comrades, including his wife. And they were the first people to translate all of these key ultra-left texts, including The Situationists, into English. Mm-hmm. And Freddie had actually been at the student occupations in the 60s in France. But they translated Gilles de Vais, they translated The Situationists, they translated all these people. But there's a footnote in one of his texts, The Continuing Appeal of Nationalism, that talks about settlers. And it says something to the extent of, someone once gave me this book, Settlers. And I was so struck by how moving its descriptions were of the horrors of subjugation and the sort of nightmare of the United States. But then I became increasingly distressed as I read on in the book, and it seemed that the author wanted the people who have been oppressed in such a way to reproduce this form of oppression over and over and over again against everyone.
Yeah.
And yes, I think that there is... That's sort of what I was referring to earlier with the sense that the Palestinian struggle is kind of overdetermined in the political framing is, yeah, I mean, that is the dominant politics. And it's true without some kind of, I will admit, I feel confused about this. I've always sort of been someone who is not a huge fan of the problem is that people just don't have the right ideas and we have the right ideas. So we'll give them to them. And then, you know, thus it is solved, QED. I'm pretty hostile to that, and I think I'm still pretty hostile to that. But it is the case that, yeah, people, unfortunately, there's a regression to the mean or something like that. And in this situation, that means an embrace of a kind of hyper-universalized settler colonial discourse where mm-hmm. the terrain of struggle is totally flattened into dividing people into one of two camps of either, you know, settler or...
Oppressor or oppressed.
Colonized, yeah. And I think that is something that needs to be overcome. But I will say that that's what's been sort of interesting about the way that identity politics has functioned in this particular struggle. And I'm not using that in a pejorative sense. I'm just using it in a descriptive sense. We know, obviously, in 2020, look, what, like 14% of the U.S. population is Black or something, which means that there are Black people in a lot of places where the struggle is happening, and therefore... You had this politics sort of emerge of, you know, listening to Black voices, the whole BIPOC discourse, that kind of stuff. And, you know, we can critique that. There's also things about it that make sense and are good. In this case, Palestinians are like less than 1% of the U.S. population. There are actually very few places where there are Palestinians. In New York, it seems really, really obvious, at least from afar, that the struggle around the war has been largely run by Arab Americans, Palestinians, and Jews, right? Mm-hmm. Which makes sense. It's in New York.
Yeah.
In other parts of the country, that's just not true. There are not Palestinians. In Chicago, there are Palestinians, which is actually pretty special. And oddly enough, the Palestinians here, you know, without putting my foot in my mouth too much, they mostly live in the suburbs and they're relatively wealthy. They're not, for the most part, you know, we're not talking about super poor recent immigrants who are hyper exploited or whatever, which, you know, there are obviously layers of that all over the country. But it means that also Arab American identity and Palestinian identity and American Muslim identity are just playing totally different functions than they have functioned the way they've functioned previously. And it means that in some cases, you know, there's a Palestinian student in, you know, these committees that run the camp and then decide to end the struggle or whatever. But it also just means that Palestinian-ness floats in a sort of interesting way. And that means that there's both like more opportunity for identification with the plight of Palestinian people, and also in some cases, less opportunities for, you know, let's call it what it is, one opportunist who just happens to be Palestinian to sort of say, well, you know, everybody has to listen to me because I'm Palestinian. Mm.
So let's transition from there to the bonus. Well, we'll be talking about Pistone, and I think this is a good point to transition to that, because what I think is really valuable about these two Pistone texts that we're going to talk about is it's one was written in the 70s, one was written, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago after the Second Intifada. And the critiques that they're making were like less critiques and just like Pistone thinking through the pro-Palestinian situation as an anti-Zionist is incredibly relevant. And his the way that he sees anti-Semitism as a danger in this movement is way different than we tend to talk about it in terms of like, are students saying anti-Semitic things or are they supporting anti-Semitic organizations? It's more this question of orienting towards the abstract, orienting towards national struggles against one another, instead of trying to rework Marxism or revolutionary politics into these movements, even when it's a very difficult thing to do. And it's not difficult because we lack imagination, but just because we're not seeing mass. This isn't like a struggle of workers versus the oppressor so much as it's a struggle of different nationalist formations going to war with one another.
The janitors at the University of Chicago and the maintenance people aren't out there on the lines, right?
To the best of my knowledge, no, not really.
Yeah, so we'll discuss that. That separation we'll discuss Pistone in the bonus episode.
And before we go,
yeah,
Daniel, are there any texts that you've read about the camps or about the situation in Israel that you would recommend to listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of mountains of stuff, right? And wading through it and sifting through it is extremely difficult because there's a lot of noise around the signal, as it were. There's a new piece that actually just came out. The Comrades and Endnotes have a dossier about Palestine that's up on their website now. And one of the texts that just came out is a collaboration piece with, I believe, a student group in Egypt that's interviews with American students on campuses, you know, who are participating in this struggle. And I think that that's a really important intervention. And as far as I know, I think it's also going to be in Arabic. So it's, you know, for a very wide worldwide audience. And some of the reflections of the students in there, I think, are extremely helpful. I also think that, you know, people would do well to try to familiarize themselves more with the sort of long arc of the Palestinian struggle, which we'll be talking about in the bonus, I imagine, because it heavily figures into the essays we're talking about. And to that end, also in the Endnotes dossier, I found there's a piece that is a introduction and a translation of a text called Waiting for the Massacre he was a situationist, Mustafa Kiati. He was the author of Two Local Wars, which was the situationist piece on Vietnam. And as far as I know, he was also one of the primary authors of On the Poverty of Student Life. He left the Situationist International to go to Jordan and join the DFLP and fight in what eventually turned into Black September,
But he would have been thrown out of the situation internationally.
Yes, and he was also thrown out of the process. and if you read Guy Debord's like letters about it, they are so hostile. He's so mean, and they're really funny. But the point is just that Chiatti tries to sort of carve out a councilist kind of alternative to how the Jordanian civil war could have played out, and that's actually quite interesting. And I think that's a pretty useful intervention as a historical intervention. In terms of more contemporary stuff, it's tough. I'll say it's tough. The one other thing that I want to say just before we wrap up, you know, because I do get to also soapbox a little bit because I'm here. The way that one comrade put it is a lot of the way that people have been orienting themselves towards the Palestinian struggle, whether it's for the purposes of trying to downplay armed struggle or argue that we should be doing it here or something like that. The politics essentially boil down to, is Hamas vegan? Mm. And this is the phrase I keep coming back to, because what it means is the question is actually like not about strategy. It's not about what we're doing. It's about like, is this thing good or bad? And should I support it or not support it? And the answer to me is like relatively obvious. It actually doesn't matter, because you don't actually have control over the way that the war is going, right? We live in the United States. I don't have a telephone where I can call, you know, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and tell them, hey, listen, we've been talking. We think you should change your strategy. So the real question, you guys should be more vegan. So the question is, how do we orient our politics in light of this sort of big geopolitical thing that's happening? And that's why you should subscribe to the Patreon, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about, right? The question of anti-Semitism is not the question of, are the protests anti-Semitic, scare quotes again.
Is Hamas anti-Semitic?
Or is Hamas anti-Semitic? Exactly. The real question is, what does this then raise for us as people who are trying to think about what it would mean to have a revolutionary force in the place that we live that was capable of interfacing with other revolutionary forces around the world, because we believe in world revolution, and end this horrible nightmare system that we're forced to live under? And that requires thinking through the problems that anti-Semitism raises, which is different from thinking through whether Hamas is anti-Semitic or whether the encampments are anti-Semitic or whether anti-Semitism is being leveled in a dishonest, cynical way. It's about what anti-Semitism actually raises for us as political actors in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we'll talk about that a little bit more on the other side. Patreon.com/theAntifada.
See you there. Dedication 5 and another one. I love it.